Coming up on TechNation, Carmine Gallo returns with the storyteller's secret, from TED speakers to business legends, why some ideas catch on and others don't. Turns out there's a science to telling your story. Then on TechNation Health, we learn that there's more in your gut than bacteria. I speak with Case Western University professor Mahmoud Ghanoum about fungus, lots of them, as in fungi. Decades of NIH-funded research tell us what they do, how they interact with bacteria, and why that's important. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
The Midwest vending machine company that inserted RFID chips into roughly half its employees, some 40 people, is only the beginning. What was covered in the media was the chip party, where the chips got inserted. But after the television cameras leave and everyone goes back to work, reality sets in. For example, sooner or later, some one of the chipped will leave the company. If you've ever had a job and left it, you turned in your employee ID card and possibly your laptop, cell phone, pager, anything mobile issued by the company. But whoever thought that nice lady in HR might whip out her penknife and say, "Show me your forearm." Yep, these chips have to be removed, or should be removed at least, but we don't have a lot of experience here. Can you imagine living to some ripe old age and whoever gives your eulogy makes mention of the fact that you have over 100 chips in your body, a bionic measure which became routine to note along with where you were born and when? But this is the here and now, which makes it so very interesting. For example, there are assurances that these chips don't have GPS and that their data is encrypted, and all that bears looking at. The idea that there is no GPS capability on these chips is intended to calm that all-too-human feeling that we don't want to be tracked. But that isn't completely satisfying when you realize that as you walk through your work environment, every RFID reader station knows you just walked past. GPS is not the only technology that can track you. But remember, collectively we have some power as a group. We can always freeze out a technology we just don't care for. Case in point, Google Glass. Sure, it worked as advertised, but somehow it was offensive. Was that person Googling me while looking me straight in the eye? Were they recording me? Google stopped selling Glass back in 2015, but now, 2 years later, Google Glass Enterprise Edition is released in development. The whole idea is that various jobs might benefit with a pair of really smart glasses, and that's not so offensive. You're trying to work on equipment, and you need some information? Bring it right up on your eyeglass screen, basically without moving a muscle. The Enterprise Edition looks more like safety glasses than fashion wear, and there's also a red light whenever you're recording. But this is about work and not a social situation. While the RFID story and Google Glass Enterprise Edition are both set in the workplace, these two technologies are miles apart. The RFID press coverage tells us that you can wave your arm and buy a snack in the break room, presumably from the vending machine of the employer. You can log onto your computer and open the door to the building. But the Enterprise Edition has far more complex capability and far more nuanced potential for applications. More importantly, when you leave work, you take them off. For those who fear RFID chips may be required, it's time to pack up and move to California. That is, if you don't already live here. In 2007, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed Senate Bill 362 into law. it prohibits employers or anyone from forcing you to have an RFID chip implanted. Can't you see him signing that bill in his state capitol office? Hasta la vista, RFID. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, how to tell a story and why that's important. Carmine Gallo joins us with the follow-on to his earlier book, Talk Like TED. Then on Tech Nation Health, we hear about not the bacteria in your gut, but rather the fungus, or is that fungi, and how they actually work together. Case Western professor Mahmoud Ghanoum explains it all. Carmine Gallo's last book was on how to make a great TED Talk. Well, this one is about great storytelling, the storyteller's secret. In some ways, they're the same thing.
They're very much related. And in fact, I probably would not have written an entire book just on storytelling had it not been for all the research I did into what makes for an effective and, frankly, a viral TED Talk. The TED Talks that capture our imagination, that people tend to share, are the ones that are based on story. I remember when I was researching the TED book, I talked about Sheryl Sandberg. I make the argument that the Facebook COO never would have started Lean In, or we never would have heard of Lean In, had it not been for her personal stories of overcoming some of the hurdles that she had in being a working mother.
And she didn't intend to tell those stories.
You know that story.
Because you told me that story. They may not all have heard the story.
That's right. Okay, so Sheryl Sandberg said, I'm a data, and this is true, it's public knowledge. She said, I'm a data head. I had all of these great statistics about women in the workplace. Her late husband, Dave, and one of her friends pulled her aside and said, you're not making a connection with people. You need to be more vulnerable. Lower the shield. Help bring people into your own personal narrative. And Moira, it was because of Sheryl Sandberg's personal story that the video caught on, that the book happened, it became a bestseller, and now everyone's talking about leaning into the workplace. Facts do not trigger movements. It's stories that trigger movements. And yet there's so much science behind it. And there's so many great examples that I really wanted to devote an entire book just to the subject of storytelling.
Well, I think it's really interesting because all of us are in a position, we're not just giving TED Talks, we're in a position where we have to make a presentation or pitch our boss on giving us a raise or changing our assignment or convincing our spouse that we don't need to go on vacation there, we need to go on vacation here. It doesn't matter what it is, we're constantly trying to get movement, whether we're saving the world or just trying to make an adjustment in our lives. And simply stating powerful facts don't matter so much, which is what we tend to do. And if we're not getting the right results, we kind of say them louder and repeat them. Telling a story does. But how do you figure out the story to tell?
One of the reasons why I think that's very important, that what you just brought up, especially in the area of science and technology and ideas, is that ideas that catch on are wrapped in story form because we are all wired for story. So if you speak to some of the people who I enjoyed interviewing for the book, anthropologists, neuroscientist. They're telling me that we've learned more in the last 10 years about how the brain processes information than we've known in all of civilization. And guess what? It's going back thousands of years to when people sat around telling stories around a campfire. We're doing the same things. I interviewed Richard Branson a couple of years ago, and I'll never forget this. He said, Carmine, my best ideas come when I'm sitting with my team around a campfire. And that's when it dawned on me, we haven't changed that much. We've changed the way we distribute information. Now you've got podcasts in addition to the radio. So the tools have changed, but the way the brain is wired to consume information hasn't changed that much. And that's why we have to get back to the ancient tool of persuasion. And the best tool we have of making a connection with one another is through story. So we can talk about what kind of stories are the most effective.
Well, you know, I was just thinking right now, because we're recording this in July. No, excuse me, it's June. I'm really getting a jump on the summer here. And everybody's talking about where they're going to go, what they're going to do. Not everybody has it planned out. And I was especially struck by what I just said, which was, where are we going to go? You want to go here? I want to go there. And I was thinking, what kind of story can I tell? What kind of story? Oh, why don't we go back to other times we had an experience that we both shared that we really liked that would tie into the place I really want to go, as an example.
You're trying to be persuasive through story.
So you're telling a story,
yes,
and you're trying to get the other person to have an emotional response, a memory response that they associate and feel good about. So that as you're putting your facts out, which don't change, you still need to put the facts out, they kind of go, oh, I remember feeling this way. I'm a little more disposed to your story as opposed to logic. There's an emotional element that is part of the persuasion.
You've absolutely hit it. And this goes back to Aristotle, who was a pretty smart guy. As it turns out, he was absolutely right 2,300 years ago when he said, in order to persuade someone of something, of your idea, moving people to action, you needed three things. One was ethos, which is character, integrity, your background, your experience. Second was logic. You had to make a logical, persuasive argument. But persuasion cannot happen in the absence of emotion, which he called pathos, which is the story. I wrote this book, and I remember very specifically when I met a billionaire venture capitalist in Silicon Valley, Vinod Khosla. And Vinod had invited me to one of his conferences, and here I was surrounded by these just young, bright people who were literally developing world-changing technologies. And Bill Gates was also there, and, you know, some of the real tech movers
all
and shakers.
All the usual suspects.
All the usual suspects. And I was looking around, and honestly, there was this feeling of, what am I doing here? And then Vinod Khosla walked on stage, and he said the words that launched my book. He said, facts alone are not enough. You have to tell the story behind the data, the stories behind the facts. You have to make an emotional connection with people. And that's when I realized, oh, I don't think a lot of people understand how to do this. I'm a journalist, and it sort of came naturally to me. And I'm sure it comes naturally to you, but based on the people you've interviewed, I'm sure you realize not everybody can tell a story naturally, and yet it is the most natural thing to us. I think what happens is we get into business or we get into science, and we think it's all about the facts and the information, and we lose the story. We lose the narrative part of who we are.
Now, there's real science here, and you almost don't need to hear it once you realize that stories can trigger cortisol, oxytocin, and dopamine. I mean, you mean it's stories, not some drug? It's stories?
This is exactly what I mean by when I said that we've learned more in the last 10 years than we've known in all of civilization, because these are folks who are in the lab. And they are doing MRI scan. They're doing brain scans. They're taking blood draws. They're trying to figure out what chemicals, what neurochemicals. And they all come back to the same thing. Stories trigger a release of the chemicals that make you pay attention. That's cortisol. So if it's facts, 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 story, oh, now I'm going to pay attention to you. Why is it that most successful Hollywood movies have to have a happy ending? You need that rush of dopamine. It makes you feel good.
You got to walk out feeling good.
You got to make feel good. There's a form. We could talk about that, too. There's a formula to hit movies. There's a formula to good presentations, too. But the most fascinating one is oxytocin. I love this one. That's the social bonding neurochemical. And there is a gentleman named Dr. Paul Zak, who I've gotten to know over the last couple of years. He's in Los Angeles, and he does these crazy experiments where he will give participants or subjects information about a charity. And he asks them to donate it to a particular charity. To other subjects, he will show a short 2-minute video of a real father and his son. It's sort of a heartwarming story about the same charity. Once you see where that money goes and you associate it with a person, there's a significantly, statistically higher level of giving to that charity. And then he does the crazy stuff, Maura. Then he starts injecting oxytocin intranasally, you know, and he boosts people's oxytocin level and they give more money. But what he finds is that people who listen to the stories, who watch the stories, have a higher level of oxytocin in the bloodstream than those who just read the facts. So he has associated stories with higher levels of oxytocin with significantly higher levels of donation. So the point is that stories actually release a chemical release in our brains that connect us to one another.
We feel generous. We feel empathic. Yes. We feel better. We feel good. We have all of those things. And yet, effectively speaking, you can use facts. It's not just TED Talks here. There's all kinds of things, all kinds of engagements. But I remember seeing Bill Clinton speak once in person. And this is after he was president, and clearly he was probably making big bucks on the speaking circuit. And I was not really paying attention. You know, it had to be 2,000-3,000 people in the room at a convention and, you know, big screens and all this. And then he got to the final. At that point, he did this drill of facts. A little too fast. You could hear the words, but you couldn't comprehend the facts. He didn't give you a little pause. He just drilled these facts out that were like, oh, oh, oh. He didn't start with the facts. The presentation wasn't built on the facts, but by the time he got to his series of facts driving it home, you were so alert. And then, you know, thank you very much. And you were like, oh, oh, what happened to me? What happened to me?
Yes.
So that your facts need to be cushioned, you know, or presented or thoughtfully arranged to make the whole thing work.
Yes. And which gets back to the whole Aristotle formula of persuasion. You need both. Absolutely. You have to have the facts. You have to have a logical structure to your argument. But in the absence of emotion, then those facts are meaningless. So you do need to have that right combination, which are people like Sheryl Sandberg are discovering. And there are so many great presenters now who are excellent storytellers, especially in entrepreneurship. One of the folks who I interviewed was some of the partners at Y Combinator, who I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with. A little under the radar for most people, but Y Combinator, of course, is the very famous seed accelerator in Silicon Valley. And they're behind companies like Reddit, Dropbox, and Airbnb. One of the partners at Y Combinator said, Carmine, we listen for stories. There's two things an entrepreneur better have. You better have passion, because that's going to get you through the tough times. But if you can't share a dream, if you can't paint a picture of where you're going with this idea and how it's going to improve people's lives in a very specific way, it's actually really hard to get that idea into reality. Because when they come to us, he said, at our level, it's still perhaps a beta of a working model, but it's more of a dream. It's not reality yet. So you need to paint a picture of what reality looks like. The Airbnb founders, especially Brian Chesky, who went through Y Combinator, are said to be great storytellers. I've had an author who wrote about Airbnb. I've had the folks at Y Combinator, and I've had some other experts who know Airbnb very well and who have funded Airbnb, who have all told me that Brian Chesky is a great storyteller. And Richard Branson told me it is very difficult to be a successful entrepreneur today if you're not a good storyteller.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Carmine Gallo. You know him from his earlier book, Talk Like TED, a former CNN business anchor. You may also have read his columns in Forbes and Entrepreneur. He's here today with The Storyteller's Secret, From TED Speakers to Business Legends, Why Some Ideas Catch On and Others Don't. Well, you can't just tell a mediocre story or even a good story. You say you got to tell a great story. What is a great story?
Well, we can learn from Hollywood because for decades, the Hollywood producers and screenwriters have understood, for the most part, you know, what makes for a good story. And so there's a difference between a story, a good story, and a great story. Let's apply this to business. And believe it or not, Moore, I actually talked to a lot of Hollywood screenwriters and to learn, and the folks at Pixar as well. What makes for a good story and how do I apply it to business? So here's one terrific example. I mentioned that Airbnb, the founders, are said to be very good storytellers. Well, when you listen to the co-founder, Brian Chesky, talk about the early years of Airbnb, he talks about the fact that there were three friends living in a San Francisco apartment who couldn't pay their rent. And so they had an ingenious idea. Why don't we blow up some air mattresses and rent them out in this extra space in our apartment? If Airbnb had succeeded right then and there and become a $30 billion business, that's terrific for them, but it's not as interesting of a story.
It's a start to a story.
It's a start to a story, and then it goes to the end. All great stories have to have conflict and tension. You can't go from a start to success. There has to be ups and downs and hurdles along the way. So what Brian Chesky does brilliantly, and if you watch his videos, read whatever he says about Airbnb, he always says the same story about how they started. They went to South by Southwest, and they launched at South by Southwest, but they only got a few bookings, and how hard it was to make ends meet for about a year. And then he tells this story. He says, there was a point where I could not even afford milk. I couldn't even afford milk for my cereal. And his mother said, you have to start drinking milk. That's ridiculous. And he told his mother this, Mom, it'll be a much better story when we succeed. He was already thinking in terms of story. But Brad Stone, who wrote a book called The Upstart, so I know you've interviewed before, talks about the fact that it's that story which is actually very important for Brian Chesky to continue to tell, because he has to build trust in a service industry where people are a little skeptical, especially in different parts of the world. They're skeptical about just renting out a place in your home for somebody, for a stranger. So in order to kind of connect with you in an empathetic manner and to show you that people were skeptical of his idea as well in the early years, that's why it's important for him to tell that story about the early years of Airbnb. But when you listen to him tell it, even though you know how it turns out, you're gripped to it. You want to know what happens next because it's got twists and turns. It's got conflict. It's got tension. It's got surprise and suspense. You can do that in a business presentation. Steve Jobs was brilliant at that when he introduced this year is the 10th anniversary of the iPhone. I still consider the iPhone in 2007 the most brilliant business presentation of our time. And it was that suspense. You know, we've got those three products to show you today. The Internet Communicator, the iPod. A new mobile phone, three things. Oh my gosh, what is it? Aren't you getting it? It's one device, and we call it the iPhone. Oh my gosh, brilliant. That's the most memorable part of that presentation. So again, there's a difference between just coming out and giving you the facts and here's our product and here's what it is and here's how it works versus building up a narrative with all the elements of story.
And then you surprise them.
Yeah. There has to be the surprise, right? There has to be something unexpected. There has to be a twist. So Steve Jobs, remember, just like any great movie, at the end of the movie, there's always a twist. He was known for, oh, and there's one more thing. So the brilliance of the 2007 iPhone presentation was he put the twist at the beginning, but there's still a twist.
Now, here's a challenge. You say over half of your presentations, short, long presentations, doesn't matter, half your presentations should be personal stories. How do you do that without coming off like, this is all about me?
Yes. Okay. When I say personal story, I've adapted that just a little bit. You have to be really good and experienced to tell those personal stories. So the reason why I say half is because of people like TED speakers, who I've mentioned in the past, people like Bryan Stevenson, who is a human rights attorney. He's the author of a best-selling book called Just Mercy, and he's won cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. He knows how to persuade. When he gives public presentations, and he gave a very famous TED talk, he will include like three personal stories in 15 minutes. The majority of his content is personal story, but that tie into his general theme. Yet he has some pretty compelling personal stories, like the day he met Rosa Parks and things like that. So he's very skilled. He's a very skilled persuader. And one of the reasons why he says we need personal stories, facts alone are not enough. You have to have the facts, but you have to wrap them in personal stories, he said, because you have to make a connection with other people. And he said the best way of making connection is by giving them something that they recognize in themselves. So he always starts with a story about his grandmother, who gave him a sense of identity. And I've asked him, I said, Bryan, why do you always, I've seen you use this, the same grandmother story many times. He said, because everybody has a grandmother.
It's a personal connection. Yeah.
Having said that, I now realize that not everybody's comfortable with personal story. Look at Sheryl Sandberg. See, now she's very comfortable talking about option B and how to deal with grief and her own story of losing her spouse. But not everybody's that comfortable with it. I think you need to have personal story, but you also need to weave in case studies, stories about other people. That's much simpler for most business professionals to do. Give me a real story of a real customer with a real problem that your product solved. That's a lot easier for people to do. And yet, very few people actually use those kind of compelling case stories. So people like Bryan Stevenson, who are in the nonprofit world, understand the power of making connections with people to advance their cause. Whether you're a business professional or you're in the nonprofit world or you're a student or people looking for jobs.
I'm speaking with Carmine Gallo, the author of The Storyteller Secret, From TED Speakers to Business Legends, Why Some Ideas Catch On and Others Don't. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of TechNation, BioTechNation, and TechNation Health are available on iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on TechNation Health, we'll hear about what else is in your gut besides bacteria. Stay with us.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with former CNN business anchor Carmine Gallo, the author of The Storyteller's Secret, From TED Speakers to Business Legends, Why Some Ideas Catch On and Others Don't. You were saying earlier, you can't just give the powerful facts, you got to tell a story. Most of our resumes are just a set of as powerful facts as we can think, and there's no story in it. So if you can weave it in, other than my hobby is gardening, we're not talking that. We're not saying that, you know. Tell your story in there somehow, some story light, so that when you get in there, you can really tell your story.
Can I give you a suggestion on how best to elicit the best story from yourself?
I think we should, because we all need it.
I think this just sort of came from just experimenting, because I work with a lot of senior leaders, and I try to, like you, I'm sure when you're interviewing people, you're trying to draw out the best stories. Well, when I was working with a healthcare startup, a CEO in the healthcare field, a very well-funded startup, so certainly his products were working and working well. But when I asked him, what do you do? Just factually, what do? That question will bring out facts. And he said, we manage cancer with a simple blood test. Okay, there's no emotional connection there, but I get it now. That's what you do. And then I asked him, okay, let's try to draw out a story here. What makes you passionate about what you do? And he said, what am I passionate about? Patient care. I'm passionate about patient care. And I thought, well, okay, that still
words,
doesn't.
Words.
Exactly. Words, marketing words. It's not going anywhere. So finally, I ask a question that I thought, oh my gosh, what a silly question to ask, but I'm going to do it. What makes your heart sing? And you can imagine.
I'm embarrassed to say that
because I'm with a group of executives. But this was a big learning for me. He paused and he said, God, heart sing. A few months ago, we were working with an oncologist who had a patient who only had a few months to live. She had a particular form of cancer, and the therapy wasn't working. They tried our blood test as a last resort, and they found that they had been treating the wrong cancer. They changed the therapy. 12 weeks later, she was not cancer-free, but with no noticeable cancer. There's a way of phrasing it these days. And you could hear a pin drop in that room with his other executives.
Finally,
you could hear this pin drop. It was so quiet. And one person said, we had never heard that before. And he said, no one asked. No one's ever asked. So now I'm not embarrassed anymore. I say, what makes your heart sing? Moira, I have had senior executives, people who you actually would recognize or brands you would recognize, break down and start crying in front of me because they tell this. It gets a little awkward for me. I don't even know what to do in the room. And I've had two or three who have actually broke down and actually started crying, who you would never expect. You would never expect it from these type of leaders. But when they are actually asked to draw out an emotional story, it completely changes who they are, how they come across. And that's why I've been recommending you have to start telling these stories publicly, especially stories of struggle, because throughout all of history, we are wired to find meaning in struggle. The philosophers have done that. So you need to tell
those
stories.
We should be embarrassed by the fact that we're struggling.
Yeah.
You know, or we struggled, as opposed to that's not shameful that you just didn't hit it out of the park at the first, you know, step up to the plate here. You know, it's really important.
You need to be open about failures and about struggles and overcoming hardships. One Hollywood producer said, you know, that one of the reasons why Rocky is one of the greatest movies of all time is because of that struggle. You know, if Rocky had a chance, one chance to go in the ring and he beat the world champion, that wouldn't have been a good story. It's the story of struggle that makes it a hit Hollywood movie. And when I've talked to philosophers and anthropologists and scientists who study our social background, they say that we are wired to find meaning in struggle, which is why we need to hear stories of hardship. You actually need to hear those stories. It makes you a better person.
Well, speaking of Hollywood producers and movies, The Hangover, very, very, very successful movie, they counted 2.5 jokes per minute. And this is relevant because?
Because humor is one of the components of story, the components of narrative that all of us need to, that all of us associate with. And which is why some of the more popular TED Talks are delivered by people who inject humorous anecdotes throughout their conversations. And it doesn't have to be a joke that's as well written as The Hangover, but it can just be sort of self-deprecating humor, like Sir Ken Robinson, who I think has the number one TED Talk of all time. And he's an educator. Who would think that an educator can be funny? But it's more self-deprecating humor. Making fun of himself for being an educator is not exactly the life of the party. So it's so subtle. I can't even remember the jokes because they're not really jokes. They're not setup jokes. It's just very natural type of humor that he injects throughout his conversation that makes it very funny.
Well, you do say that. You don't need to tell a joke to get a laugh. And I was actually telling students about this in a course I was giving recently, and quoting from your book. I just wanted you to know.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
And they were doing one after another real quick presentations. And I, you know, you get to know the students pretty well. And there was this one young man who was given a presentation. And before he started, I said, you know, I just want to tell you that this humor thing is big. And we've been watching you for a long time. And we always know it's pleasant. You're giving the same, you know, kinds of presentations in classes. But I said, we always know we're going to get sort of this humorous side. And I said, so go ahead. And he goes, hey, that's pretty good, huh? You know,
yeah,
here's
the
thumbs up. And the way he said it was actually humorous.
Yes.
But it's not a joke.
Yeah.
And he has this lightness of being about him to kind of say, well, don't look at this picture, you know. And of course, you're looking at the picture. And it's just a pleasant way of telling a story that kind of, when he speaks, he's talking to you individually, even though there's a small group in the room. It's so I think that there's a lot more work, I think, that can be done here as we watch other people present and we think about this and we study it. And I know you will, because you never stop, Carmine, to say, how do you do that? What are we really seeing?
I had mentioned Steve Jobs. People forget how funny he was. I recently, because this year is the 10th anniversary of the iPhone, I recently rewatched the wonderful keynote where he introduced the first iPhone, and I found someone who had analyzed it. They had found 51 times in one presentation, 51 instances where the audience laughed in a business presentation, a product launch. He would do things like he crank called a Starbucks. You know, you remember that famous one. Can I have 4,000 lattes, please? Oh, no, sorry. Just kidding. Yeah, he hung up. But little things like that, 51 times people laughed in a business presentation. But if you look at the older Steve Jobs videos, 1984, the introduction of the Macintosh, he was formal and stiff and serious. He wasn't as lighthearted. I think there comes a comfort level. Very few people are that comfortable when they're first starting out, especially in their careers, as they are when they get a little bit more comfortable and they start realizing that it's important to have those connections with people.
So at the end of every chapter, you give the storyteller's secret from the chapter. And at the end of the book, you consolidate that into a short list. Thank you very much. And one stood out when I actually scanned the short list.
Okay, remind me.
And that is reframe the story you tell yourself.
Thank you. Yes, very few people pick up on that, but I think it's one of the most important parts of the book. And I'll tell you exactly where that came from. You cannot be a powerful, persuasive, charismatic, dynamic individual in terms of the way you communicate if you don't believe in your own story. So belief comes first, and that's what I mean by reframing. And now there's a lot of psychology out there. There's been some wonderful books on the topic. I think psychologists or psychiatrists call it reappraisal, which means you have to look at what's happened to you in a different way, in a more positive way.
Well, Carmine, thank you so much. Please, you're always welcome on Tech Nation.
Thank you.
My guest today is Carmine Gallo. The book is The Storyteller's Secret, From TED Speakers to Business Legends, Why Some Ideas Catch On and Others Don't. It's published by St. Martin's Griffin, now out in paperback. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. Welcome to Tech Nation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies. Today we hear about not the bacteria in your gut, but rather fungus, or the plural of fungus, fungi, and how they actually work together. Dr. Mahmoud Ghanoum is a professor at Case Western Reserve University and University Hospital's Cleveland Medical Center. His research has been supported by NIH with over $25 million in grants, and he's published over 250 peer-reviewed papers. I asked him, in recent years, we've come to appreciate that we have a microbiome in our gut, and the conversation has revolved around whether we have the right bacteria in our gut or the wrong bacteria. Why is this an incomplete picture?
Because in our body, we have both bacteria, fungi, as well as viruses. So when you look only at the bacteria, ignoring the fungi, you are really looking at half of the pictures. And what's interesting, having these bacteria and fungi together, they cooperate and work together in both in health and disease. So that's why it's very important to look at also the fungi in addition to the bacteria.
Now, you've been working on this for over 30 years. You've gotten over $25 million from NIH to discover all kinds of things about fungi. How do you determine the interaction between bacteria and fungi?
That's a very good question. When we started our research, we looked at the profile of what is in the gut of people with respect to bacteria as well as fungi. And then we looked at it in also Crohn's disease patients. And we found that there is an increase not only of the bacteria, but also of the fungi, particularly Candida tropicalis, one of the species of Candida. So with that in mind, we thought, since both of them increase, bacteria and fungi increase in these patients, they must be working together. We went back to our culture collection. We have a large culture collection of organisms at the Center for Medical Mycology, and we picked Candida tropicalis, E. coli, and Serratia, which are the two bacteria which increased. We put them together because inside our gut, the organisms are not free-floating. They come together and they form what you call digestive plaque or digestive biofilms. So when we put them in our experiments, we notice that they work together and they really start to form a very robust or thick digestive plaque. So our experiments, which followed our observation from patients, showed that they work together. And this gave us the idea that we really need to study them together and understand how come they work together from the mechanistic point of view. And that's what we are doing now, hopefully.
Okay, so then that means that we have digestive plaque, I guess, lining our gut here. What difference does that make?
The difference is when you have digestive plaque in healthy situation, it's good because it tries to control and balance the bad bugs. The problem becomes when you have bad bugs, such as bad bacteria and the fungi, when they come together and form this plaque, what happens, they become protected from not only our immune system, but also from antimicrobial agents, like antibiotics, for example. Bacteria in that plaque is protected by the matrix which forms the digestive plaque. So that's why it's very important to break this down so that you are able to eliminate the bad bugs.
So you could have the right antibiotic for the bacteria you're going after, and you can't get at the bacteria.
That is definitely the case. And this has been well established in not only in our gut in general, when microorganisms, both bacteria or fungi, form a plaque, they become resistant to antimicrobial agents.
Now, while you're a professor at Case Western and you direct the Center of Medical Mycology at University Hospital, you did spend part of your career at UCLA School of Medicine. And in fact, you're not an MD, you're a PhD.
Yes.
In dermatology?
This is a very interesting story because usually fungal infections are put in departments of dermatology. Why? Because a lot of people have nail infections or they have athlete foot. And that's why conventional situation, they always put them in dermatology. But the interesting thing in UCLA, when I was at UCLA, I was in the department of infectious diseases. So where it looks at more the systemic infections. So you have two faces of the coin. The superficial infections, such as I said, nail infections, you know, or onychomycosis, are dermatology. But when we look at candida and systemic infections or oral thrush, it is in infectious diseases. So we marry both.
Now, when you're working with NIH, I know you do some volunteer work for them. What area are you working with them in?
In NIH, I work mainly in infectious diseases. Why? Because infectious diseases, like, for example, candida, can cause high mortality. It kills people. So therefore, the NIH wants to spend money to study candida. If I go and put a grant to study nail infections, they are going to tell me, go home, because this doesn't kill patients. And that's why the focus is on infectious diseases.
Now, you also have an MBA.
Yes. You know, I was, because I work with the pharmaceutical industry, I helped them in their drug development. I worked with various companies. And for that, I interacted with a lot of business people. So it came to my mind, you know what? I really should do an MBA to try to understand how these people think. So that's why I did it.
I speak to so many research scientists, and they're saying, you know, I see a product here, I see a product there. And they either don't have MBAs or they're just not, they have MBAs, but they're not sort of by personality suited. The other problem is it means that if you're really going to start a company, it takes away from your research, the very thing that you did well. But you had the great foresight to have a son.
Yes, certainly. That's where I am very lucky, because my son and I work together and he is the business brain. Even though I did MBA, believe me, he is the person who can think about it and keep me on check.
So you can continue to be a professor and direct the center, but you and your son started up this business.
Yes, that's true.
Well, now let's talk to you, Afif.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Afif, tell us about pathobiome.
So after my father came out with his study on Crohn's patients, and for the first time what they figured out was that while we'd known for a long time that bacteria and fungi had some sort of relationship and it seemed to be that they were keeping each other in check, really what my father discovered was that for the first time, bacteria and fungi were actually working together to protect each other by creating digestive plaque. So he got literally thousands of people reaching out, asking two questions. One, how do I actually figure out what's in my gut? And is there a probiotic you recommend? And so my background is as a biotech attorney. And so for years, my father and I have been actually taking sort of his scientific prowess and my biotech background and launching products. We've sold products in about 27,000 stores. And so we looked and we said, okay, it's kind of interesting. There seems to be this gap because for a long time, the role of fungi has really been ignored.
We've been talking about probiotics. Is there such a thing as a profungal?
So there are some probiotics that do have fungi in them. While a few do have fungi, the problem is that's not what you need. You actually need a combination of both. So that's the approach we took. We did two things. One, we created the first probiotic engineered to address not just bacteria and not just fungi, but also digestive plaque. So we did that by combining bacteria and fungi and an enzyme that we knew was pretty powerful against plaque so that we could break down that digestive plaque and maintain the total microbiome of the gut.
Now, you do have this biome, which you can take once a day, but you also have, which goes hand in hand, or at least if may even be more important, this gut discovery kit. Now, tell us about that and what you get from it.
Right. So one of the things that we found were that in this age where consumer genetic sequencing is becoming more common, and there are a number of sites that will tell you about your heritage, for example, through your genetics, were that people wanted to know what is going on in my gut. And the problem that we found was that there was really no one looking at both bacteria and fungi. So what we did is we developed the Biome Gut Report. And through a sample, we can actually analyze people's bacteria and their fungi in their gut. And then what we do is we use NIH's human microbiome data on bacteria to show them what normal gut levels look like. But then due to my father's years and years of clinical research in fungi, we actually have a baseline of normal fungal flora that no one else has developed. So that was what we wanted to do, was allow consumers a way to really see what their entire gut microbiome picture looked like.
Now, what could you see in terms of a fungal report that would you could do if you say, oh my goodness, I'm either way below or way above what I should be for a particular fungus?
Fantastic question. So what we know about microbial balance is that it's multifactorial. There's actually four things specifically that can affect it. One is genetics. So some people are predisposed to microbial balance or imbalance. And obviously the extremes of that are conditions like Crohn's. Then diet is a giant factor in the balance of your microbiome. And part of that as a subset is alcohol. We've actually seen that alcohol in their studies showing that a glass of red wine being the exception, alcohol can really disrupt the balance. And then oddly enough, stress can actually affect and lessen the diversity of your microbial balance. As a result, when people look and see if either their bacterial or fungal levels are off, there are a number of things they can do. They can, obviously you can't adjust your genetics, but what you can do are optimize some of the other things that are lifestyle related. For example, your diet. You can eat prebiotic-rich foods, which prebiotic just means you're giving a friendly environment for probiotics and fungi and bacteria to exist. And that's everything from, leafy green vegetables to avocados, like a sort of a Mediterranean-style diet. The other thing you can do is obviously supplement your diet with a probiotic. And then manage just your stress of everyday life. And, even Dad is religious about yoga, and I'm religious about thinking about exercise. So, between the two of them, we got it done.
With all of the gut reports you're getting a lot of data, anonymized,
sure.
Getting a lot of data. You never got that kind of data in all these decades of studies that you were doing. I mean, are you able to use that?
What's so important now is the discoveries, as you said, with recent advances in technologies such as deep sequencing, as well as the bioinformatics. Doing this analysis, it's really giving us a lot of data, which very, very helpful and insightful, because if you are able to harness this information, you will be able to, for example, characterize this is what people's microbiome should be, fungal community, bacterial community, how we can control it. Is it different with different people who are on different diets, for example, or geographic regions? So this is very powerful data. And the good news is that we have a really very strong team at Case Western Reserve University with bioinformatics background who can help us put all this this information together and dig deeper to try to understand what is the biological relevance of these or the clinical relevance of these. And this is a truly exciting time from that point of view. And definitely we can use this information.
Now, I saw a lot of the bacteria and I recognized it. And then I saw a whole lot of fungi that it's like some of them I kind of go, oh, anything starts with candida. Yeah, two of those. But it went down. There were a whole lot of them. How did you decide what to put in the analysis?
That's really a very good question. What we thought is, let's look at what are the good fungus that we need in our body. What are the bad fungus or the one that could cause a problem? And as you mentioned, Candida, for example. So we selected those organisms that we know if they are up or down, they may affect the balance of your gut. For example, if you have a lot of Candida, overgrowth of Candida, then that is not very good sign. However, if you have Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is a yeast, it is good thing. So that will allow us to look at you, the profile of a person, and say, you know what? You have the right mix. If you don't have the right mix, then it is possible to adjust that by either the use of probiotic or, as Afif mentioned, my son, is by adjusting your diet. So there are good ways to bring this the balance back and restore.
So the other thing we did when we selected the organisms to include in the gut report, you know, if we listed all of them, you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of species that we'd probably pick up. And frankly, if you had, you know, spicy tacos, you'd probably pick up some interesting species in a reading. So what we did is we really concentrated on what we call the core microbiome. And that is fungal and bacterial species that we found showing up in 20% of the population over and over, which indicated they're really core organisms that had import in gut balance. So the other thing that was fascinating, and we talk about, you know, how much data we're picking up, while my father's been studying and doing very sophisticated global fungal clinical trials over the last a decade, in the first 6 weeks we've been doing the Biome Gut Report, we have more data than he's had in all those years.
You know, what really occurs to me, Dr. Gunam, is that, you know, in the old days when you're out on the farm and you had a family, you tried to have as many people as possible, hopefully a good mix of boys, you know, to work the farm. And, you know, now I think if you're going to be a research scientist, you should have a good mix of kids that can grow up and get a profession, professions that will help you.
That's
okay,
true.
Okay, I'm going to put that in my advice to young scientists now.
Thank you very much. I'm so lucky that my son and I work together and we enjoy each other's company.
Well, thanks for coming on. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Mahmoud Ghanoum is a professor at Case Western University and director of the Center for Medical Mycology. His son, Afif Ghanoum, is CEO of Pathobiome and a contributor to Forbes.com. More information is available at biomehealth.com. That's biomehealth.com. For TechNation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BioTechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BiotechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcor. We'll